Do you have an idea for a podcast, but you don't know where to start? Maybe you're overwhelmed by all the tech or you're convinced nobody will actually listen to you. Well, I'm Shauna Game. After 9.5 years as a professional podcaster, at this show, Everyone's Talking Money, and 25 million downloads later, let me tell you the secret to a profitable podcast. It is building a solid foundation, your podcast roadmap before you launch. That's why I created the Podcaster Class, a fast-paced group cohort podcasting for profit 8-week style MBA program. The Podcaster Class is immersive, comprehensive, and insanely motivational. If you want to create a podcast, DIYing a launch is just not the way to go. In the Podcaster Class, you'll get the tools, tips, and strategies to create a podcast that resonates with listeners and one you can be proud of. Get this, 90% of podcasters never make it to episode 3. That's 2.8 million podcasters who just quit. So to be a top podcaster, you only need to publish 21 episodes, but you got to make them good. So in the Podcaster Class, I'm taking the mystery out of how to create, launch, and profit from your podcast so you can create a top 1% podcast just like this one. The May cohort is now open for enrollment. Classes start May 22nd. There are only 15 spots open. You are going to learn podcasting with me and 14 other amazing people. You can learn all the details at thepodcasterclass.com. Use code podcast when you sign up for $100 off. That's thepodcasterclass.com. I'm going to be real with you. Identity theft is on the rise, and you do not want to wake up one morning and discover that your bank account has been emptied, or you're overdue on credit cards you never even applied for. We talk about this often on the podcast, but you don't realize how much of your information is available to scammers on the internet and how susceptible you and your family are to identity theft and fraud. I know, it's scary, but now you can get your data removed with Delete Me. That's why I personally choose Delete Me. Delete Me is a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential ID theft, doxing, and phishing scams. I just started using Delete Me and I got my regular personalized privacy report. I was shocked what they found and removed. It was pages of information about me that I did not want online. Here's how it works. You sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts take it from there. I cannot tell you how relieved I felt to have Delete Me. And you know, it's also a great service for your parents or grandparents to help protect them from identity theft. Delete Me is not just a one-time service. Delete Me is always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you do not want on the internet. Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special price for my listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/ETM and use promo code ETM at checkout. The only way you get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/ETM and enter code ETM at checkout. joindeleteme.com/ETM. Go to joindeleteme.com/ETM and use code ETM for 20% off.
You know, knowing the details of what everyone's up to, you know, these things loom larger than they need to be. It's like, oh, why did you, you know, buy the latte at work? Couldn't you just bring coffee? Like, that probably doesn't matter too much. And, but some people think, you know, these are big deals. Or maybe we have like different interests or passions and hobbies, and we don't understand each other's worlds in that sense. My wife is a needle pointer. I have occasionally stumbled across invoices for what these things cost. It's not what I would have expected.
Welcome to Everyone's Talking Money podcast. I'm your host, Shauna Game. There's no judgment, no dumb questions, just smart conversations about you and your money. So come on in and grab a seat. Everyone is welcome here. Hello there. Welcome back to the show. I am Shauna. This is Everyone's Talking Money. And I just wanted to give a big thanks to Tasha, who wrote this review for the show. She says, I love this podcast. It helped me seriously like money a lot more, and I can have conversations without freaking out. So many great episodes, and I always leave each episode knowing a bit more than I did before. So please don't stop. Tasha, thank you so much for this review. I'm so excited that you're a listener, and I always love when somebody gets something great out of each episode. I know not every episode is for everyone, but if you could just take away one thing from each episode, then I kind of consider it job well done. So if you've not left a review for the show, I would love, be honored to have you leave a review. You can add right to the link in the show notes, or you can leave a review in whatever podcast player you're listening to this episode in right now. All right. I want you to raise your hand. Are you a tightwad or a spendthrift in your relationship? I have to admit it, honestly, I am mostly the tightwad. But don't get me wrong, I do love to spend money too. But get this, tightwads are more likely to marry spendthrifts than they are to marry someone like themselves. That's what motivated our guest, Scott Rick, a behavioral scientist at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business, to write his new book, Tightwads and Spendthrifts, Navigating the Money Minefield in Real Relationships. So he was in search of one answer. Can seemingly opposing financial personalities coexist peacefully? It's a good question. In this episode, we're going to get to the bottom of it all. We're going to talk about how do you make peace with your partner? What is financial infidelity? Why financial translucency, aka not sharing all the details of what we spend our money on, could actually save a lot of partnerships? And how to talk to your kids about money so they don't mimic your tightwadness or your spendthriftness. So grab your partner or just slide this episode their way after you listen. It is a great way to open up a money conversation. All right, let's start. The premise of your new book, it revolves around this one question. What if I'm a tightwad and my significant other is a spendthrift? And we already know that it is just like a landmine when we're talking about couples and money and trying to, you know, manage money together. I think let alone if you're at, you know, opposite ends of the spectrum of how you, you know, quote unquote, do money. So I thought, like, let's just start here. How do I know if I am the tightwad or the spendthrift in my own relationship?
Sure. No. So we have a scale, a little questionnaire that people can fill out. I think most couples have a sense of how these things are going, but it can be, I think, useful to get it on paper and get some feedback and see where you stand relative to kind of thousands of people who have already completed the scale. And, you know, that can give some useful context in the relationship. Certainly, it, you know, I'm a spendthrift and I'm married to a tightwad. And, you know, it helps to interpret some otherwise ambiguous behaviors, like some gifts from me to her or from her to me. And it's not just kind of a pure signal of how much we love each other or how much we understand about each other, but it's also kind of, oh, how comfortable you are or I am spending money and how we use money to express affection. And so it's right. It's kind of a useful, like, oh yeah, there's, you've got that going on.
It's interesting as you're talking, I'm trying to think in my own marriage. I think it's weird. Like I have tendencies of being a tightwad and then tendencies of being a spendthrift. I think it like depends on the situation. I would kind of say the same thing about my husband. Interesting enough, we grew up in very different backgrounds and money, the relationship with money and how money was talked about and dealt very different. You say though that tightwads and spendthrifts are more likely to marry one another than they are to marry someone like themselves. I find this like really interesting. Tell me about
this.
Yes.
You know, first I should mention that, you know, on our scale, I focus on the tightwads and spendthrifts. They're kind of the extreme ends of the distribution, but there's a middle ground of what we call unconflicted consumers. And it sounds like you and your husband might be there. And, you know, that's kind of a happy place to be where you're sometimes one, sometimes the other. They tend to be kind of happiest. they kind of spend more or less what they think they should, whereas the tightwads are spending less than they think they should. Spendthrifts are spending more than they think they should. And both of those extremes are kind of conflicted in their approach to money. And when you have something about yourself that's kind of bothersome or kind of something you're self-conscious about, you don't love to see that reflected in someone else. It shines like a really uncomfortable spotlight on it. And so you might initially be kind of repelled by people who have like your problem. And so that's why we think at first it's kind of fun to be with someone who approaches money very differently. It's kind of fascinating and funny and charming. But over time, it gets a little trickier once you get into like bigger decisions. You know, when you move from dating to where to live and where the kids go to school and should we remodel? And now those differences that were kind of charming and fun are like, a little
really annoying. Yes. Yeah. Hence like the conflict, right? That comes up and you're like, I used to find you really charming and now you're annoying me. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So can these two like polar opposite type people, can they coexist in like a really financially peaceful environment, or like, how do they get to that place?
Sure. Well, part of it is over time, you kind of can fix each other a bit and kind of move towards the center. And we see that relationships that do kind of survive over time, you do see a little movement, some convergence over time. And that's a good thing. The couples where you don't converge, you see a lot of fighting, or they're not a couple anymore. they kind of fall out of the sample, scientifically speaking. But so there's that. But there's also kind of how money moves in the household and what we know about our partner and how they use money. And I do think account structure can be a way to kind of minimize unnecessary friction over money. So the structure that I love, and I have some research to support this, is like all incoming money gets laundered through a joint account. So it's all our money. There's no kind of yours and mine. It's just all ours. But then we each have a separate account attached to that joint account. And so we each can take from the joint account as needed. Maybe that's on a schedule. We agree like, we each get X per month. So we each get a little piece of our money to spend kind of without close monitoring. Because knowing the details of what everyone's up to, these things loom larger than they need to be. It's like, why did you, buy the latte at work? Couldn't you just bring coffee? Like, that probably doesn't matter too much. And but some people think, these are big deals. Or maybe we have like different interests or passions and hobbies, and we don't understand each other's worlds in that sense. My wife is a needle pointer. I have occasionally stumbled across invoices for what these things cost. It's not what I would have expected, right? It's but whenever you're not like an expert in something, you can't tell the difference between like the good or bad version of it. Like if I know nothing about art, it's like an art print is going to look like, I don't know, is that the real thing? So we don't have the expertise to kind of judge each other's spending. So as long as we can kind of keep it within some agreed upon general number, I think the details are just unhelpful. So it's, you hear a lot about financial transparency within relationships. I say, well, how about financial translucency? Like it's, you get a sense, but the details, they're available upon request, and hopefully the requests are few and far between.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I came up with this idea a few years ago when I was a practicing financial planner, and I worked with a lot of couples, and it was more of, I was more of a therapist than I was actually, you know, helping them with their money. And so I really got firsthand knowledge of the behavioral side of money and the relationship with money, and how much about money and how we interact with money, and certainly how we do it in relationship, we just don't understand, because we don't spend time like exploring, well, how did I grow up and what patterns am I mimicking, and you know, what generational traumas kind of come through, and like all of these big things that play this big role. And I was working with a couple, and I came up with this idea of, I called it a don't ask, don't tell spending limit. And so it was this dollar amount that you could agree on, that each other could spend up to that amount. And there were no questions. There were no judgment. Like there was just nothing, you know. And I like what you're saying here, because this idea of translucency is like, okay, I have an idea, but you also have some sort of free rein to spend money, and maybe that can create like a healthy, you know, coexistence.
I think so. And you can build in, some guardrails. I think the first step is like, oh, let's, you know, I have a sense that we've been pulling stuff out of the joint account maybe more than we planned on. Can we do some self audits? All I need to hear from you is that you did it. I kind of trust you to look over your numbers. And if you see something's amiss, you know, I trust you to kind of address that. Now, you're always free to say, I'd love to get another pair of eyes on this, and invite someone in. And that's great. And we should do that as desired. But the default, I think, is we have some autonomy, some individuality that we get to maintain, a little privacy. Whereas, yes, we need to know kind of the big number, but not the components.
You know, where do you think like some of the landmines exist, like with couples that don't set up kind of these boundaries and guardrails and have these conversations? Is it largely because we don't maybe understand our own thoughts and feelings around money, and so we bring them into a relationship and we start projecting things like judgment and shame and all of these things that, like, you know, we're not comfortable with ourselves, and then it just creates like an even bigger eruption in a relationship?
Yeah, no, I think eruptions in romantic relationships and just any interpersonal relationships, kind of not kind of understanding where you're coming from and why. And I do think that's a useful exercise. You know, filling out a scale is like one version of that. You know, as I'm sure you've discovered over the years, like talking with trained professionals is also kind of a useful thing to do to explore that. And, but no, it's helped kind of, again, just kind of knowing where we're coming from. And, you know, given how you react to money and anxieties around money, I know how you'll interpret this question, or I have a sense of how you'll interpret it, or this gift or suggestion. So it really does help to kind of navigate that minefield. It takes a lot of learning and curiosity about kind of your partner. That's one of the things I mentioned in the book. Like, you might feel like you really know each other, but you know, if you audit like recent conversations, like if you just kind of recorded what you've been talking about, a lot of it's going to be, oh, who's taking the kid to soccer practice, and like a lot of like immediately practical things, but not really like
depth,
delving into their psychological world, which is really important.
So speaking about that, you are a behavioral scientist, and I love that the book is written from that perspective, because that's certainly my jam. One of the things that you argue kind of along this line is that we're more likely to mimic the behavior we see our parents do versus what they say about money. I love this idea. Like, how does this influence our like current spending? You know, how did whatever our parents did, how does that influence us now?
Yeah. Well, it depends on when your now is. I don't think we come out as like young adults looking and acting just like our parents. But as we start to age and confront some of the similar choices that they confronted, I think we do start to kind of mimic more of what we saw. So eventually you do see kind of kids somewhat turning into their parents on
that's
money
scary
dimensions.
Scott.
I know. And this was like a useful thing for me to research because I have three young boys and very, you know, impressionable. And, you know, I don't necessarily want them to be a spendthrift to the degree that I am. You know, I want them to enjoy life, but maybe, you know, be careful out there. So I'll tell them things maybe we don't need to spend that money just yet. Hold on. But then they'll see me do stuff. And that may be very much at odds with what I'm telling them. You know, if I'm telling them to hold on to the gift money from grandma and then I just like buy the new iPhone for myself when I already have a perfectly fine one, you know, that gets muddled. But yeah, so what we see is that the what they see you doing is a much better predictor of what they end up doing than kind of what they hear. But what they're hearing is usually, you know, these extremes are kind of saying, well, don't be like me, do as I say, not as I do, but they often do as you do.
How do you do that research? Like how do you find out, you know, these kind of like trends?
Yeah. So, well, one interesting method is we bring parents and kids into a lab and like a real kind of, it feels like a living room. And we give them like money scenarios to talk through, just like where it's not clear what these characters should do. And, you know, the kid says, oh, maybe this character should keep their money and not buy the toy. And the parent will say, it's okay to buy a little toy. Or, you know, we see kind of how the parents respond to the kids. And we see kind of the extremes kind of suggesting you don't have to be as extreme as me. Yeah. So they're kind of reeling in their kids a little bit. But how the kid ends up behaving, like if we let them loose in a little laboratory store and give them money to buy toys, it's much closer to kind of how the parent behaves than how the parent verbally guides them.
Okay. So kind of knowing this perspective, then if we have kids, or let's say we're getting ready to have a kid, how do we talk to our kids about money and you know, I think, you know, how do we teach them about money knowing that like our complexity with money is like so complicated just itself?
Yes. Layers upon layers. It's, you know, one thing it's helped me to recognize is like, oh, they don't kind of arrive on the planet kind of knowing what that credit card means and kind of, you know, that just seems like a free gift card to them. And so kind of spelling out, well, what this means is I do this because, of course, you keep in mind that later I'll have to pay money to this bank. And so I try to, you know, get those kind of basic financial literacy things. And they enjoy talking about that and learning about that. Even if something is not really painful for me to spend the money on, because I am a spendthrift, I might kind of perform some pain just to make them think it's not like a hot knife through butter for me. Like, oh, I don't know.
Okay, right. There's a little drama, right?
A little, yeah. I think like, what would my wife do? Okay, I'll say what she would say. And then occasionally I'll be like, oh, maybe I don't have to buy that thing that I would just normally buy on my own. Or maybe this can be an online purchase after they go to bed. Like they, you know, there are things that they don't need to see every single thing. But yeah, it's just kind of being mindful that they will it's not just kind of the explicit suggestions that they're going to pick up. It's really kind of a true mimicry that is waiting to happen there.
When it comes to financial advice, you got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I was paying for vacations all wrong. I was missing out on miles. I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? I don't know, maybe that fancy hotel upgrade that you have always been dreaming about. Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. Okay, friend, I want to know, what are your money goals this year? Are you saving to buy a house or maybe a wedding or a dream vacation to somewhere tropical? If that's you, please, please take me with you. Or maybe you want to just grow your emergency fund because, let's be real, life is expensive. I want to make sure you reach your goals, so you need Monarch. That's why the Wall Street Journal named it the best app for growing your savings. Monarch is the top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. You can create custom budgets, track progress toward your financial goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/ETM. Here's what I love. Monarch is the most customizable budgeting app. You can change the layout of your dashboard. You can go between light and dark mode. You can create custom budgets and notifications. You can set up all of these automatic rules for your transactions and notifications, and so much more. Monarch is obsessed with constantly improving their product. Get this. They release updates every 2 weeks, and they even allow customers to submit suggestions, vote on requested features, and view the product roadmap. This, my friend, is totally original. Plus, they will never sell your data to third party or show you ads. I think that's really important. After trying out Monarch for myself, I understand why it is the top-rated personal finance app. And now, listeners of this show get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/ETM. That's monarchmoney.com/ETM for your extended 30-day free trial. In those moments when money is just not moving as fast as your dreams, Earnin provides the financial momentum you need to keep moving forward. Earnin is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 per day or up to $750 per pay period. You just download the Earnin app and verify your paycheck. Then you access up to $100 a day as you work, and you can leave an optional tip. Any money you access plus tips are automatically repaid from your next paycheck. I honestly would use Earnin in lots of different ways, but what's on my mind recently is I need a night out. I need some good tacos to sip on a few virgin margaritas and celebrate you all helping this podcast earn 26 million downloads. Make Earnin a part of your financial routine and join Earnin's over 3.5 million customers who say things like, "When I think about Earnin, I think about financial stability and security. Gives me a lot of peace of mind." Download Earnin today, spelled E-A-R-N-I-N, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the Earnin app, type in "Talkin' Money" under podcast when you sign up. It will really help the show. "Talkin' Money" under podcast. Earnin is a financial technology company, not a bank, subject to your available earnings, daily max, pay period max, and location. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank & Trust, member FDIC.
All right, Scott, so we're going to play your relationship with money is game. So question number one, if you had to describe your relationship to money as a cartoon character, who would it be?
It's tough. I think it would certainly be someone from the Looney Tunes universe. As a spendthrift, I kind of feel like Tweety Bird. He kind of gets himself in trouble. Like Sylvester often grabs him, but you know, more or less, there's usually a happy ending. So I haven't yet been kind of eaten by the metaphorical Sylvester, but and you know, the Tweety Bird seems to have kind of a fun swing in life, and you know, as a spendthrift, that's where I like to dance, like a little risky, a little fun. Have to get out of some jams every now and then, but I think that's me.
All right. Question number two. What first thought comes to mind when you think about money?
Yeah. The first feeling is probably some anxiety, but mild. But it's more about situations involving money. We got to close on our loan for the remodel. We got to figure out a way to pay for, you know, my mom recently moved to town. Like there were some decisions that had to be made there. And so it's more anxiety around kind of just like taxing money involved decisions. Yeah, but mild, I think.
All right. Question number three. If you had an endless supply of money, what's the first thing you would spend it on?
Well, you know, I do love to dazzle the children. So I would, you know, they're into baseball cards and they've gotten me back into it. So I certainly they would get like autographs from their favorite people. And if not just flying to the games to be in the front row, probably in that neighborhood.
All right. Last question. What is one money secret you have that maybe you haven't shared very often?
In writing the book, I think I kind of explored some of my past. And, you know, I grew up in Houston, but a lot of my time was spent in Vegas. My grandparents lived with us in Houston and they kind of got bored and they said, "We love you, but we're moving to Vegas." And that was kind of sad, but we were like, "Oh, we get to visit." And so I spent a lot of summers as a youth just like hanging out in casinos. And it's pretty fun. I looked older than I was, which was fun then. It's less fun now. But so I didn't get too much trouble from the security guards. But it was a very interesting look at like non-optimal financial decisions, let's say. And not, you know, some of them were bad, but they weren't terrible. So it was an interesting, you know, daily exposure to this balancing of financial and psychological well-being, that I feel like I've kind of carried that desire for balance into my adult life. Sometimes you see people who seem to be kind of too high on one or the other, but I strive for a balance from my Vegas childhood.
The weather is getting warmer. I'm so excited, and it is time to say goodbye to all those jackets and sweaters and hello to the shorts and t-shirts. I wanted to update my summer workout wardrobe for the long haul without, you know, spending a fortune. Luckily, I found Quince and I am in love. Quince is your go-to place from everything from premium European linen dresses, blouses, and shorts from $30, washable silk tops, timeless, 14-karat gold jewelry, and so much more. The best part of all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes those savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. Okay, I bought the dreamiest pair of workout leggings and a bright pink workout top to match. Honestly, ladies, I gotta tell you, these leggings you need. The price cannot be beat, and I feel like a million bucks wearing this cozy workout-friendly outfit. I've worn it for like 5 days straight. Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/ETM for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/ETM to get free shipping and
365-day returns. Quince.com/ETM.
I'm sorry, but I have the best dog ever. Her name is Winnie Stardust. She is a mini golden mountain doodle full of life, and I would do just about anything to keep her happy, healthy, and safe. Today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. Your pet is part of your family, and you want to do the best for them. But vet bills can really add up. We jokingly keep telling Winnie she needs to get a job to pay for her vet bill. That's why you should check out pet insurance. And with ASPCA Pet Health Insurance, you can focus on the care your pet deserves and cover what matters most. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customized accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping to ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you are least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/ETM. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/ETM. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/ETM. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independent American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer, is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
You know, I've read a lot of articles. I've done a lot of talking about money trauma, and I'm a certified trauma of money specialist. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of research that still needs to be kind of done in that area. And, you know, there isn't a specific diagnosis like there is, you know, PTSD or anything like that. But, you know, one of the things that I learned that I really think has a kind of great importance is when your parents didn't talk at all about like the things that they didn't say, you were still picking up cues and you were developing this kind of unconscious relationship or relatability to money that you didn't even know was there. So sometimes we talk about it like, what did our parents, you know, say or do? But what if there was like a void of all of that, but you still, you know, picked up some sort of trauma or response? I don't know. It's so fascinating to me. Like it's very, very layered, like an onion kind of peeling back, but I think it's really interesting.
Yes, very much. And so, yeah, I try to debrief them on some items because, you know, we're exposed to a lot of inequality in both ways. And, you know, it's hard for them to wrap their mind around. It's like, why can't we do what this other family did? And you know, we can't explain every single choice that affects their economic lives, but we do try to just tell them kind of the mechanics of the system and helping them understand the world that they live in. It's very tricky.
Yes. Yeah. If you can explain that, I would love to have you over to explain it to me.
Yeah, right.
Okay. So couples, so we have these different sort of spending habits. Are there things that we should be talking about like ahead of conflict? Like, should we spend more time talking about our thoughts and feelings around money or what's kind of really going on versus just, you know, I'm blowing up because you're spending, you know, $150 at Target every week.
Yes. I mean, you know, first step is, do I need to know how much you're spending at Target? and of course, what does it mean to spend X dollars at this place? Like, do I need to see the receipt? Like, it can mean so many different things. But again, as we discussed, like having those kind of private individual accounts, seeing things at a high level. It kind of getting to know what is on your partner's mind, what is stressing them out, what is kind of what are they looking forward to, what are they dreading? These are useful things to explore. And keeping in mind also that a lot of us kind of overweight the small stuff. So yes, maybe it was a mistake to have bought that indulgence, whatever the item is. But in the grand scheme of things, that's probably not the difference between kind of wealth and not wealth. It's there are bigger systematic factors at play there. So that kind of like deprogramming is also just helpful.
So there's also something interesting. We talked about that idea of financial translucency. You talk also about financial infidelity and that this has been used, you say, like far too broadly in covering kind of harmless behaviors, and that, you know, spending that's out in the open is usually what gets couples in trouble. So tell me a little bit about like what actually is financial infidelity then?
Well, as far as I can tell, any behavior that falls short of complete proactive transparency is considered by many to be financial infidelity. So one example from a pretty popular personal finance website, I saw this and kind of stopped me in my tracks. So you go to the store, you go to a grocery store, you spend $100 on groceries, you pay with debit card, and you withdraw $20 in cash on top of that. And you don't tell me that. So if I see the bank activity, I'll see, oh, you spent $120 on groceries. I won't know that you had a little $20 spending spree. And so the fact that you didn't disclose that is financial infidelity. To me, that seems kind of unduly strict. I think for many of us, I don't care if you withdraw money and don't tell me about it. You know, things like, does your spouse kind of tell you how much they're spending on gifts for friends or family? I don't tell this to my wife. She doesn't tell me. I don't care. I hope she does get her friends and family nice gifts. My goodness. there are just things that we don't need to know. And so I think a lot of innocent, perfectly functional behaviors are being labeled as financial infidelity. And, I can understand why it gets a lot of attention and, but I don't know, it seems a little overblown to me. Of course there are acts of truly deceptive financial behavior, secret addictions, affairs. I mean, these are, big problems. I'm not sure they're financial problems. They involve money, but, they're not for someone like me to solve. I mean, you need, counseling and treatment and, I'm not sure, a different account structure is going to solve
that.
But yeah, as you note, I really think it's like the unaffordable mortgage we both chose to enter into that's more likely to sink us than, you know, these little undisclosed financial decisions, moving to the wrong city when you don't have the income for it. And, sending the kids to private school when that's not affordable. It's those are the big ticket things that can really do you in.
You put together this whole book. We've talked about so many different pieces of this, but I'm wondering, like, what are some of the biggest, like, ahas that you took away from all the research and kind of putting together this idea of, you know, managing money in a relationship?
Yeah. No, I think I certainly the account structure insights were kind of a useful aha moment. I'll call it a moment. It's kind of the result of like years of research kind of building to it. But that has been quite useful. Certainly the children aspect was a wake-up call. I do think through this process, I've learned to be a better gift giver, which, you know, might not sound like such a big deal, but it's like, these are big moments. There's a lot of them. If you're like a married parents in the United States, like you've got five or six locked in times per year where you need to produce a pretty good gift. And, you know, there's a lot of advice out there like, oh, just ask them what they want and get that. Sure. I mean, it's very risk averse, I think. I mean, I guess it's meant to avoid a disaster like, oh, here's a new ironing board or something. but no, I think my interpretation of kind of people's stories and the research is that it's really about kind of understanding your partner and using this as an opportunity to kind of express that understanding and the appreciation that sometimes we're just too shy or tired to do verbally. Like we're more likely to appreciate our partners than to tell them how much we appreciate them or why. It might just seem, again, if we're having a conversation about very practical things and who's going to take the dog for a walk and like all these things, you know, it might feel too weird to bring up like, you know, these qualities that we admire about them. And it's just like, okay, well, let's get back to the grocery order here. Right. So yeah, these are the big moments for a lot of us. And I think it's essential that we kind of be curious, take time to learn about each other, ask each other questions. I suggest some in the book. There are questions that have been proposed for like strangers to like become really close within like an hour. But I say like, even in a marriage, you could use a refresher on some of this stuff.
Right.
Like, do I know like, oh, who my spouse would love if they could have anyone over for dinner, who would it be? Like, I don't know. But like hearing who they would pick, it's like, okay, interesting. Why would you pick that? Oh, you're thinking about, okay, that's good to know. So it's, yeah, that's been an essential insight.
Has it helped your own relationship as you're kind of going through this and like trying to see this stuff from like another perspective too?
Yeah, no, because I used to be really bad. I'm less bad now, but I used to be really bad. Yeah, like I tell one story in the book about early in the marriage, I knew she liked Kate Spade. And so it's like, okay, well, I'll get her something from there. You know, I knew she had other accessories. I was like, oh, I'll get her a handbag. And so I went to the place and I saw things that kind of looked like what she already had. And any one of those would have been fine. But then I saw this like really gold, glittery, over the top. Like if I wore purses, that would be my purse. I like a loud accessory, a fun sneaker, like things like that. And it was like way more expensive than the others. And I thought that's love. That is, I'm going to wow her with that. And, that's not her. It's just not her. And so we were with her family on that Christmas and she opened it in front of them. And this was in Pittsburgh. Her close family's from Pittsburgh and they're like real Pittsburghers. Like they're not like,
they're going to say
not fancy.
It like,
Yeah. I mean, they're perfectly lovely, but they're, yeah. And she opened it and it was just silence. Just, you could hear the tumbleweeds and the it was just so clear that I had laid an egg and not a good egg. And her dad was like, oh, you gonna wear that down at the Kroger's? Like, yeah, it was just so clearly expressing a misunderstanding of Julie, my wife. And yeah, so that hurt her. That really, and I thought, I'll spend extra to show extra love. But it was actually just a big negative. So that was quickly retrieved. That was back before New Year's. But yeah, it's, as a spendthrift, my inclination is to spend to show affection, but a good gift requires sacrifice, I think. And spending for someone like me is it's no sacrifice. I do it all the time. If I want to sacrifice, I need to do some legwork. I need to plan something or track down some merch from a band she likes, or, you know, a playbill from some show that she enjoyed. Like, got to put in the effort. Her, on the other hand, if she buys me something expensive and, you know, something that I like, of course, but that's a real gesture. Like, I know it hurts her.
Right. She had to let go of that money.
Yes. And so for her, to me, that means something. So we have to demonstrate our sacrifice kind of based on kind of what we know about each other. And so that has been very useful to kind of think through.
So, you know, we're up on this time, like end of the year, beginning of the year, kind of starting where people are thinking a lot about money and goals and all of that sort of stuff. So, you know, if we're in a relationship and we're either the tightwad or the spendthrift, like, how do you suggest, you know, this time of year, how do we come together? How do we embrace spending and really, I think, do it from more of a, you know, sort of partnership aspect?
Yeah. So certainly when we're jointly spending on others, like kids or our parents, you know, that's great to do together. Certainly I should not be left to my own devices to buy the gifts for the kids, because I'll go overboard. And so it's a good, you know, my wife helps me kind of control myself, and I kind of help her loosen up a little bit. And so hopefully couples can embrace that and, you know, recognize that there are some productive disagreements that can happen. And but again, with the new year coming up, I mean, that is the perfect time for a fresh start. And a lot of behavioral science suggesting that these can be crucial moments to kind of fine tune your habits and approach to things. And, you know, I have a chapter in the book about how you can kind of take steps to loosen up as a tightwad or to reel yourself in as a spendthrift. And it's all kind of turning up or down the dial of how much attention you're paying to money leaving your possession when you're spending. So, like, you know, I'm a spendthrift, but when I was in grad school, you know, money was extremely tight. So I really had to, like, ratchet up my own pain around spending. And so I would only spend in cash, and I would kind of train myself when I go to the ATM. That was a painful moment because the account got lower. And then when I would spend the cash, the wallet got lower. So that was like double pain. You know, I'm not sure that's like a recipe for happiness, but just to get through a rough time, I was able to dial up the distress. And if you're a tightwad, I think there are ways to dial it down. You know, looking at things in terms of investments, you know, sometimes other people can help you reframe a purchase or a decision as an investment. That kind of thinking helps a tightwad. Getting kind of outside objective feedback on your financial situation. Like, you can convince yourself like, oh, I'm going broke, or, you know, sometimes, hopefully not too often, but sometimes that can be true. But it can also help to kind of get someone else to say, oh, you look pretty good to me. Loosen up. You're okay. Yeah. So, yes, New Year is a great time to reset.
I love this idea of financial translucency, right? Like not sharing all the details of what you spend your money on. I think it could really save so many partnerships, relationships out there. And like Scott was saying, we're not saying you should lie to your partner, but you shouldn't have to justify every little thing that you buy. I shared this in the episode, but I think it's a great idea to set this limit, this amount of money that you can spend without questions, without shame, without judgment. Any amount over that, yeah, you got to have a little conversation. But I think it's just a really healthy way to set up your money partnership so that there's still some freedom. But of course, there are, you know, some boundaries around there. It takes a little practice. If you want to grab a copy of Scott's book, Tightwad and Spendthrifts, it releases in early January, so you can go right now and pre-order it everywhere books are sold. If you enjoyed this episode, send it right now to your partner or to friends who are partners and tell them, all right, you got to listen to this on Tightwads and Spendthrifts. It is going to literally change your relationship. Hey, and I also want to give a big shout out to all of the sponsors for this episode who make this show possible. You can head right to the show notes to get all the links and all of the information that we talked about. I will see you back here, my friends, in a few days for a brand new episode.